Welcome back to Season 11, Episode 36 of the Digital Orthopedics Podcast, where we bring you the extraordinary lectures from the DocSF experience held in San Francisco in 2023. My name is Dr. Stefano Bini. I work at the University of California, San Francisco, and I will be your host for this podcast. In our next episode, we'll hear from Zev Kane. He will have an incredible panel, including John Warner, Mark Gruner, and Steven Schutzer, to talk about value-based care. So please join me as we welcome Dr. Kane to the DocSF stage.
Why don't we start with a round of introductions? Let's start from the left. John?
So I'm an orthopedic surgeon. I went to Harvard Business School later in my career, mainly inspired by Michael Porter and his ideas about value-based healthcare. I then took a course on innovation in healthcare with me and a bunch of VCs, and then went full boat on the executive program. And everything that I do now since then is viewed through the lens of value. And I think one of the things we should probably talk about is try to define value, because it's different things when you talk with administrators or vendors or yourself or the patient. And the biggest problem I think that I see is lack of alignment. Steve?
Steve Schutzer, orthopedic surgeon, hip and knee arthroplasty, JP with my resident, but we're not going to go back that far. I've been involved with value-based healthcare since 2008, set up a couple of centers of excellence for joints, spine, sports, and trauma, launched a startup, Upswing Health, I pitched on Wednesday, and a co-founder of a grassroots organization called the Moving to Value Alliance.
I'm Mark Gruner. I'm a sports medicine physician and co-founder and chief medical officer of Limber. We're a remote therapeutic monitoring platform and also work on innovative value-based care models. I worked at CMMI for a brief period of time and drank the Michael Porter Kool-Aid and did my training at Mayo Clinic, where I've been working on innovative orthopedic value-based care models.
Thank you. This is a fantastic panel, guys, because they represent a multidisciplinary group just in front of us. So the first question is the following. I'm sure that, or the first point of discussion, all of us have heard about the amalgamation or suggested amalgamation between Kaiser and Geisinger, right? Everybody heard about it? It's supposed to be one of the biggest deals of healthcare ever. That's supposed to create a new organization that's going to devote, it's going to be a new platform for value-based care. So we heard that. We just saw Amit's brilliant presentation about how value-based care is just about here. Now, I'll be honest with you. When I started our conference in the same year Stefano started his, 2017, I thought it's right here. It's tomorrow, right? It's tomorrow. It's the big deal. It's a decade later. It's not here yet. But there are a lot of things this year, especially with Kaiser and what Amit said. So let's start from the left again. And I want an actual answer, and then you can give a small explanation. But do you feel that there is an inflection point now for value-based care adoption in orthopedics? Let's not call it orthopedics. Let's call it in the musculoskeletal space. And it's a different question, obviously. Yes or no, and then an explanation. But I need a yes or no first.
No where I am, yes maybe elsewhere. Because everything's contextual, and we all work in different environments.
I'm talking about, think about your community of orthopedic surgery.
So overall, moving in that direction, but not yes, no. But an optimistic, almost. Can I just, you said explain something. So I work at a very complex, large medical center that's getting more and more complex because they're doing their own kind of merger scenario where Mass General and Brigham are now becoming Mass General Brigham, like that's hard to pronounce. And they're making themselves bigger and bigger. In order to control the market and do the opposite of value-based care is what I kind of see. That said, we published on a value-based care model created by physicians and brought it to the organization with a warranty on outcome, et cetera, and they turned us down. That was about 10 years ago, and that was with Bob Kaplan from Harvard Business School. So I tend to be a little bit cynical where I work, but optimistic that you out here are going to do a better job than we do.
Okay. Steve.
Yeah, it's so hard to say yes or no. As a bright spot optimist, I would say yes, more likely than no. We heard a lot about it here. You know, you think about the inflection point, I go to the diffusion of innovation curve, and are we at that 16% where this is going to gain steam and sort of become unstoppable? I think so. How about you?
I would say not yet. I've been working on the models for 15 years. I was talking about this with you earlier, Zeev. I think that we have to be really smart about getting claims data from payers. You know, my companies were funded by Blue Venture Fund, and I talked to a lot of payers across the country. and they're just not there yet. And so they have to be able to give those claims quickly and concisely to providers to know how they can intervene and be able to design some of these models, and they're not really there yet. But at the same time, there's a lot of innovation and other ways that we can get there, but not yet.
I'd say yes in 5 years.
That's fair. Next question, and it's really driven by Amit's presentation. I was intrigued when Stefano presented our panel. He says, we're moving now to the health policy area. So I don't perceive value-based care as a policy. I perceive it more as an operational model, but that raises a very interesting question, Amit, which is it possible that some of the lack of success of CJR was because they really just focused on the money issues and not changing how we actually practice? And so I'm putting it out to you, and think beyond just operating, think about the entire perioperative episode. And you think that that could be an explanation why we are just not saving enough money, because simply we're not focused on the practice itself.
So I'm very much involved in this, and from the standpoint of I analyzed the finances of our department in the ambulatory center and the main hospital, and looked at structure and culture at the same time. And the biggest problem is alignment and control, to be fair. We control all these resources that lead to cost. And we know from analyzing that if you do a rotator cuff repair in my institution, the cost can vary by a factor of 8, depending on who's doing it. So you don't really need to, it's not hard to figure out who's gaining money, who's losing money. The problem is, how do you motivate humans and behavioral motivation to make that shift? And the only way to do it is with alignment. And what kind of alignment are you talking about? Co-management gain sharing? Is it going to be punitive for certain things or what? And in my experience at my large academic medical center, that kind of alignment has been slow to come. But that will go very far to creating value for everyone across the process, if we become collaborators, not employees, in this process.
You know, I think CJR, first of all, BPCI preceded CJR, and it was voluntary. So those entities that saw an opportunity opted in. My organization never did, because we had already cut out the FAD, reduced length of stay, sent people home, no ECFs. So we never opted into BPCI. CJR was involuntary, so entities were not prepared to, there was no alignment. And it was hospital-based. You didn't have much choice. It was a hospital-based program. And if you're in an MSA, then you were in it. So I wasn't very optimistic about it from the start.
I think it's a little complicated, but there's 5 things that can really show value in orthopedic care. There's changing the site of service, lowering ED admissions, going downstream or upstream to address appropriateness of care. But in order to do all these things, you need to really collect the data and be able to collect those patient-reported outcome measures. And if you're not tying and coordinating the care of the episode together, then it becomes really challenging.
I agree. I think the 2 big things are the incentive question around how do you make a health system whole to make it worth their while. That is a really hard thing to get over. And the other is the operational questions, right? And the integration of care and data.
So I think that's where I actually have an advantage, guys, because I am an anesthesiologist and a perioperative physician. And when we developed the perioperative surgical home model, the idea was that before the patient gets to you to operate on, we need to optimize the patient to start with. If the patient has a hemoglobin of less than, if the patient has a hemoglobin A1C larger than, if the patient has respiratory diseases, all those things will determine the lengths of stay and the cost. And that's why the challenge is when you just use it as a financial model, you're missing all that, because you really have to optimize the patients. And by the way, you can look at lengths of stay, but to me, there's a triad of lengths of stay, discharge disposition, i.e. the patient goes home or goes to a nursing home, and readmission. I can change lengths of stay to 1 day. I'll just send everybody to the nursing home, right? And I can send them from there after 1 day, but then all will bounce back. So that's why I think that it has to be a more complex clinical model, and that's how you get more into it. There was a recent report, also I thought by Bain, that talks about how 80% of the physicians support value-based care. However, it dramatically reduces based on the downside risk that they get. So your response is how to fix it. Do you think that is it first, do you think that report makes sense that I support value-based care as long as there's no down risk for me and maybe an upside risk? But once there is, it's a real problem. Let's start from this side now.
I think that's absolutely right. So I think when we've done similar surveys, right, just the level of understanding and conviction in having the capabilities needed is very low, even though the awareness of the models is high. And that's where conveners and sort of capability enhancement of physicians, whether it's an MSO, whether it's other models, become really, really important. Because what you can do there is absorb some of the downside risk and still make it so that you're sort of gradually transitioning the physician community.
You know, selling to orthopedic groups and PT groups across the country, I can tell you that it's been really impressive seeing how many people want to do value-based care on the provider side, but the incentives need to be there and they have to be correct. And it has to be a glide path to that. So that's why I helped create the remote therapeutic monitoring codes, because I think you got to use these codes to provide services to get there, coordinate the care, but that's only one piece of it. You have to be able to start with shared savings and then work to a capitated model. Orthopedic surgeon cannot take risk right away. They do want to know what that benchmark is and be able to dip their toes in the water. And if the incentives are there, they'll go after it and be aggressive, but it can't just be full risk right away because it's very unpredicted. And I think that's something that we really have to take into consideration.
Yeah, I think most of my colleagues support value-based payment models. And we've had a bundled payment program, Steve, since 2010. And the reason is, if you look at the percent of the dollar that the surgeon got without the bundle is about 6% of the dollar. But in a value-based model based on TDABC, we didn't kind of pull the number out of our hat, the surgeon's piece of that dollar went up threefold. And all they had to do was follow 22 clinical protocols. I mean, that's all they had to do. But it wasn't that bad. But they did, and they adopted that. As far as risk, you've got to have the data. But again, if you look at the opportunity, isn't that where the $1 trillion is? Isn't taking that risk and arming people the proper technology to manage that?
So I'll answer it a little bit based on history and based on what I know. And we work with Bob Kaplan from Harvard Business School and the chief medical officer of a HMO called Harvard Pilgrim, and came up with a warranty on outcome and a bundle. And I'm not talking about capitation, I'm talking about a bundle. And we warranted the outcome, so we took all the risk. And we were turned down, and largely the reason was that it would have replaced a relatively lucrative contract that the hospital already had with that insurer. So why would they want to partner with us? But there's a very, very interesting article published that I'm sure most of you never saw in the 1980s in, I think, arthroscopy. Lanny Johnson was a pioneer in innovation in business, and he created a bundle himself with a local insurer in near Lansing, Michigan, with a warranty on outcome for 1 year for all the arthroscopies he did. And his profit went up 30% that year. And I mean, he did this in the 80s. And here we are trying to redo this sort of a thing. And I think the most important thing is to be able to deliver and minimize your risk. And that may be the case in certain kinds of procedures versus other procedures. But you build that collaboration with the contracts you have, and then you scale it accordingly. So far, the alternative, at least where I work, is much more attractive for the organization than doing that.
So do we think that, quite honestly, even the word risk implies just a downside? What's the upside? And you did address it to some degree, but I just want everybody, what's the upside for an orthopedic surgeon if they'll be part of a risk-sharing model? Upside, not downside.
It can be lots of different things, but I just told you, you can have a premium for taking the risk. That's one thing. And or you can do co-management gain-sharing model with your organization, and that assumes some risk as well. So it also ensures that you may have a more attractive product and thus a greater flow of patients to you, particularly if you're doing direct contracting with an organization. So it has a lot of different forms, but at the end of the day, you have to define some value for the physician who's doing it, because they're the ones, you know, hospital may be taking risk, but they are as well. And the problem in many organizations is when you have high performers and low performers, who gets into it and who doesn't? Because the low performers or the low volume surgeons will statistically have a higher complication rate, and that may blow up your agreement.
You know, for orthopedic surgeons, Steve, the upside is the downside, right? I mean, if I think orthopedic surgeons are gradually, and I mean, you mentioned this, 60% of the spend is on probably mistreatment, waste, low value. If orthopedic surgeons become managers of MSK, they can accrue the value that they really deserve on the downside. But, you know, the upside becomes a downside for an orthopedic surgeon.
Yeah, I think for an orthopedic surgeon, there's two things. One, making sure that they have a higher volume of appropriate patients. So at Mayo, I always thought it was interesting that every patient that a surgeon would see, they would have a 50% surgical rate. In the DC area where I practice for a private practice orthopedic group, it's for every 10 patients they see, they have one surgery. So it's improving their surgical rate if they can create a good model. But the more important thing, and that's where I think value-based care can go for that, but the more important thing that's really, really, I think, one of the biggest challenges, but you'll see it more in the private practice orthopedic groups, is if they control the entire episode. So from the time someone gets seen for that musculoskeletal injury throughout their entire episode, that's where you'll see more value and be able to create more value and use physician innovation to try to think about new models to shift care.
So Amit, can you please define for the audience, I don't know how many understand the difference between an episode of care bundle versus a condition-based bundle?
So I think that's a really good point, Mark. So I think the traditional bundles in CJR, BPCI start when a procedure happens, right? So a TJR claim drops, and that's where they go 30 days before and 90 days after, some variation of that. So you're really anchoring it on a procedure, and you're only going to see the value for the patients that had the procedure. So what you're not doing is actually getting at a lever where the procedure didn't need to happen in the first place. The way you can do that is to start the arrangement when the diagnosis is made. So now, if you have the patient who had knee pain, if you prevent that patient from having the procedure by using conservative methods, the entire cost of the procedure becomes the savings, because in the past, they would have gotten that procedure. So that becomes the savings. You've saved that entire cost of the procedure and are getting value from it. I'll say maybe two other things. Of course, that means your professional fee for the procedure went away. So how do you sort of get over that? The way you do that is by getting sort of a broader pool of patients in what you're managing. And if you are able to demonstrate sort of better outcomes, better patient satisfaction, let's not underestimate the value of that, right? Better patient satisfaction by engaging the patients earlier, educating them, navigating them, you become more attractive as a network to payers who are then now willing to put you in a preferred tier or narrow their network, et cetera, get you the better volume to take care of that delta. Last thing I'll say is we should not underestimate, doctors became doctors for a reason. It's to provide care and to drive outcomes and to drive health. And reinforcing that, we've found, is incredibly important.
I agree. And people become orthopedic surgeons because they want to operate mostly. So we now basically think that you expect orthopedic surgeons to do a lot of MSK management, which they may or may not want. And I'm asking the panel because they're orthopedic surgeons.
I'm going to let the orthopedic surgeons answer that.
Yeah.
I'll take that first. I think we should. I mean, who else, as you mentioned, MSK is a top three category of plan spend year over year, right? It's an enormous space. Who better to manage MSK than orthopedic surgeons?
Oh, I can think about a bunch of specialties that are costing less to the system.
That would cost less?
I mean, we can talk for a second about family practitioners who got specialized training in sports medicine, and they make much less money. And they, for a non-operative, they may deliver the same level of care. So it's an interesting challenge.
But what you're describing is Clayton Christensen's idea of disruptive innovation. And that is that you get a less expensive alternative that can scale to the larger marketplace. And that's happening anyway. And AI may be part of that as well. It may be disruptive innovation through AI in terms of the things that we now do. What's happened, however, at least where I am, my vantage point is, and it's connected to burnout, is all of the documentation that we have to do after our extensive training, which is completely contrary to the business model that Kaplan and Porter would have in terms of the experts should do expert things, not menial things. And so this makes it a very complicated question to answer. But I think inevitably what we've been talking about with AI, and that's going to disrupt a lot of what we do and provide value in and of itself because we get back time, and time is money. The other point I wanted to make is if you talk about value and then you want to talk about who is actually getting the value, the patient, the doctor, the hospital, the vendor, whatever. Value is temporal. And particularly in joint replacement surgery, the longer you go from the time of the surgery, the more value the patient gets, which can figure into how we make decisions about the implants we use and the cost of them. And cross-linked polyethylene is a perfect example, because there was some resistance at my institution, even though they created it, to allow the doctors to use it because it had a price premium connected to it. But of course, ethically, that's the patient capturing all the value downstream. So there are all sorts of components here in terms of when you talk about value or value-based care, whatever, is how long you're looking at and who's capturing the value. And that's a tug of war, if you will, in some ways.
So I asked the question, and here's one suggested solution to the question, which is if a large orthopedic group owns the bundle, okay, let's talk about, you know, an Orto Carolina, for example, or Proliance or Rothman, okay, they own a bundle. Now they can actually hire or refer the patients to family practitioners who are experts in sports medicine. And then only those people who need have surgery by the surgeons who, by the way, their time, it's like, honestly, it's like taking an F-35 pilot and asking them to do something that less qualified people can do. No offense to anyone, okay? But that's a model. That's a model that maybe people will engage to.
No, I mean, I think that's the model of the future, because a lot of people will say that when you go see your primary care doctor, you might not get the right diagnosis. But if you get the right diagnosis, you triage, you risk stratify, you attribute that provider, that orthopedic provider early on in the episode, then you really can manage the episode more holistically. And I think that's the key, is finding that attribution to be either the physician visit of the specialist or when they see that physical therapy evaluation within that orthopedic group, and then starting that and measuring it over a 6-month or 12-month episode and going at risk in that model is what's going to be successful in the future.
Dick Rothman, 35 years ago, figured that out. He had a layer of primary care docs working with the orthopedic surgeon. So my colleague, for example, Bill Hozak, would see 8 patients a session and book all 8, spend an hour, you know, 45 minutes with them. He thought of that 35 years ago.
I'm going to say something that may be a bit provocative, but I'm going to say it anyway, which is that, look, that's going to happen anyway. You're going to see primary care groups that are taking risk, payers that are sort of vertically integrating, start to create those ecosystems, start to sort of divert care towards lower cost. And one way to think about this is that as an orthopedic community, you can choose to lead that, or you can choose to receive it, where you become essentially the contract provider for when the patient needs the operation.
That is the case. And in fact, if you talk to one of the leaders in that space, HOPCo, you'll find out that they are already in contact with primary care groups to get the bundles together and allocate the bundle together. And that's the answer as far as that. Now, we are obviously in a great conference on technology and AI and innovation. So let's bring that into value-based care. Can AI / technology, all the fancy things we've seen here, help value-based care in any way?
By no means am I an expert, but I know some. And, you know, I think the answer is resounding yes, because it will take tasks to take our time. And, you know, one accounting methodology is TDABC, or time determined activity-based costing. And so when you give back time to providers, you give them value. So certainly that's a motivator for what it may do. It also will help patients. We've already seen that patients have found an AI to be more empathetic to their needs and their questions than a human. So that's coming for sure. And if that's part of your bundle, if you start at that point, you're going to reduce your costs by doing that.
Yeah, I've learned a lot here, Aziv. In the last couple of days, I see incredible opportunity for innovation and technology, especially filling in the gaps in care, right? We see a patient one day, we see him again 3 months later. What happens to them over that 3 months? What are they eating? Are they taking their medications? The whole notion of care coordination and navigation, I think technology is going to accelerate value-based healthcare.
Yeah, I strongly believe that technology will improve value-based healthcare, and it's because you need to be able to collect the data. You need to be able to improve therapy adherence at home. You need to be able to coordinate care better. And that's where data can come in. And when we really want to get really clever with some value-based care models, risk stratifying and triaging the patient early using machine learning models from patient-reported outcome collection will be extremely innovative. That will help the doctor be more successful, deliver different clinical interventions.
Yeah, I think I wholeheartedly agree. And I would say it's not sort of an improvement, it's a necessity, just given how fragmented data is. And that's actually one of the tipping points. One of the reasons why we think there's a tipping point now is because there is a much better ability to stitch together data and now to apply machine learning.
So let's be a bit more granular. Okay, everybody agrees that it's good. Now let's talk about specific technologies and how do you think it will help? So let's start with something easy like wearables. How will, you know, one of the challenges I hear from providers about wearables is like, I have a lot of data, but who's going to analyze the information? And by the way, who's going to pay me to analyze the information? So I get these tons of wearables, but what do I do with the data? So let's start with that. Who wants to take that one first?
I can try with that. I think the problem with wearables is ease of use and reproducibility and cost versus digital ways of determining joint motion, this sort of thing. But that's going to be solved. And of course, we're going to have implants that are going to be giving information as well. So I think that's going to be a real plus in terms of how we manage our patients. It's not hard to imagine how we can scale telehealth effectively with these approaches or even have this substitute to some degree, and that AI can monitor or watch over how the patient is recovering in a way that alerts us when there's an outlier. And I think patients will very much like that approach. We already see app-based recovery programs out there, and these are ripe to be have this kind of technology embedded into them to be sort of the watchful eye as the patient recovers.
Excellent.
Yeah, it was funny. My wife went to her PCP the other day and came home with this thing on her chest. I said, what the hell is that? She said, it's a monitor, the new Holter monitor attached to her iPhone. And sure enough, over the last couple of weeks, she would get a call from somebody, you know, you just had an APC, are you having any problem with your blood pressure? I was shocked by that technology. She may have gone to the emergency room or so there. We just saw it in real use.
Yeah, I think the wearable needs to be affordable. I do think there's some amazing things with computer vision, just using the smartphone. I think tracking step counts using a smartphone or using computer vision. I think there are several things that we'll see where technology, being able to coordinate and know who's at risk or who's falling off, I would say falling off the door of, you know, not doing well, are going to be some of the things that we'll see.
So now connect that to value-based care.
So you want to start first? Or?
No. The question is for you.
Okay. Yeah. So in order for that to happen in value-based care, you have to, A, have reimbursement models that reimburse for these services, and that's where the remote therapeutic monitoring codes could be there. But then you also have to measure these outcomes, and then you have to tie them together in a value-based care model, an alternative payment model, where you have a benchmark for a number for cost, and you're measuring those quality measures. And if you hit those costs and the savings, then you can be successful in a value-based care model.
Amit?
Yeah, I mean, if that wearable, the stability indicator sort of prevented a fall that prevented your hip fracture patient from going back to the ER, there you go. I mean, you've saved $5,000, maybe $15,000, right? I think that the key there is like, how do you cut through the noise that wearables always have? And I mean, I think there's two parts to it. One is, who do you deploy it to? Right? It's not that there's probably a subsegment of patients where it's really going to sort of make a difference versus not. And the second is, how do you use your technology and your data and machine learning to cut through the noise and sort of find the patient where it's going to be helpful and find the signal? So I think those two things need to be solved.
I think the really important thing is using that data to make clinical decisions that are actually important.
Yep.
And so if it's just tracking step counts, if it's just tracking range of motion, and you're not changing the clinical care of what's happening for that patient, then it's useless data.
So I'll give you one simple example that have yet to be integrated, which is one of the challenges, is optimizing patients before surgery. Again, I mean, that area. I think 7 years ago at University of Michigan, they made a study that showed essentially that if you put a podometer or something that counts your steps before surgery for 30 days, and you give the patient a target and actually execute it, the post-operative outcome were way better. By the way, they also did CAT scans and showed that if they decrease the amount of fat, it's way better, but that's more complicated. So here's a question. That was 7 years ago. Why don't we implement this? Why is it? It's such a simple thing. 30 days before surgery, put a pedometer on patients, they're wearable. If they walk, they'll do better post-operatively.
Start? I mean, because you didn't make money doing it, right? That's one reason, right? I mean, I know I said it blithely, but the thing is,
I actually think it's not lightly. I think that that's the reason, by the way.
Again, because what happens is that you need to invest, right? To do that, you need a care manager. You need somebody who's going to look at that data, call the patient when they're not doing it, engage with the patient, which is all investment. And unless there is a return on investment, even with the best intentions, you're not going to do it. And so I'm not speaking solely from a profit motivation here. It just, you can't justify making that investment. And that's why the business model and the clinical model and the operating model all have to go together.
And that is one of the challenges, is that once you get into a hospital, and now I'm talking as a hospital administrator, it's the challenge is that it's siloed and the budget of the OR is separate than the budget, yes, of the floor. Yeah. And certainly the budget of the hospital is from the minute the patient walks in until the minute the patient walks out. They really don't care about anything that will happen outside from a financial perspective. And so you're right. The question is, I'm going to optimize the patient as a surgeon. Okay, I'll do it because it's the right thing to do. But who is going to monitor the patient? Who's actually willing to pay for it? I had challenges in hospitals because I've implemented these models in multiple hospitals around the country in convincing hospitals to simply get a CBC test 6 weeks ahead of time. So we know the hemoglobin is 6 weeks ahead of time so we can intervene, because they said, well, we don't have an authorization yet. We don't know that the patient will go to the OR because the pre-authorization is typically done only 10 days before because they may change an insurance carrier. So we really have a problem with a disjointed payment system. Do you guys agree?
Can I just comment here? You're dead on, and Bob Kaplan wrote about how hospital budgets interfere with innovation, because exactly what you said, the money's siloed in different areas and who's the owner. But I think there are opportunities for us to be influencers, particularly if you have somebody motivated who's a quality and safety chair or something like that, and they're working with your chief information officer, et cetera. Those kinds of collaborations change structure. And I don't see this happening unless the structural change occurs.
So Xavier, you brought up the question of who's going to pay for it, right? And I've thought a lot about that. I mean, there are two categories, those who have to, being forced into it, those who have to because they're in a at-risk model like an ACO or a CIN or advanced primary care group, and then those who see the business opportunity to access that $1 trillion. But there's plenty to support the innovation.
Yeah, I think that's why I'm biased, but I helped create these remote therapeutic monitoring codes because there's now good reimbursement models for if you just want to stay in fee for service, you can use pedometers, you can use technology and now get reimbursed for it and get bypass the CFO when they're looking at an ROI evaluation. But it's not just that, it's coupling it with value-based care models. But if you have the orthopedic department and innovations and technology where the EMR and they're not talking, they don't communicate and they don't coordinate, it makes it really challenging for hospital systems.
So we are at the end of our panel. Before we conclude, anybody wants to say one or two sentences to the audience that you really feel burning need to say?
I'll start. You know, major innovations often start small in scale. So congratulations, you're clearly going to scale this. The key problem for you, I think, is how do you get your message out there? How do you scale your message? Because that will change the way people think. And since some people are early adopters, they may not know what you're doing here, and it's important to reach out to them.
Thank you, Stefano, for putting on this conference. So again, I'm bullish on the future of healthcare. I think we didn't talk enough about the model that's going to embrace all of this, and I'm a big fan of advanced primary care, technology-enabled advanced primary care, which we as specialists need to fit symbiotically into that relationship. But I'm very excited about the future.
You know, I want to thank Stefano also for having me here. And I truly believe that technology, these new remote therapeutic monitoring codes, will be a glide path to some innovative alternative payment models. And that's where I think the future is going to be.
I think the panel has said it all, and not much I can add. I think the one thing I'll add on to is the point around sort of investors and the interest in the space. People see that $1 trillion and it creates a ton of opportunity. So for partnerships and as physicians, that sort of support on building capabilities is there.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the Digital Orthopedics podcast. If you find the talks as incredibly informative and topical as we do, please share them and share the podcast with your friends and leave us a nice review on your podcast player choice. It would mean a lot to us if you do.